So you have walked into creatures of our own devising, a critique of the modern self. So the plan for the next hour, I'm going to talk about five pillars that people use, whether they know it or not, modern people use to build their identities. This task of self-creation that is so much more fraught in some ways now than it has been for human history. Everyone has always had to become someone, but that process is different now than it was, say, 500 years ago and any time before. We'll talk about that a little bit. So that's the first half of the lecture, the 5 points of the modern self, and then the second half of the lecture is the 5 points or pillars of the Christian self. So if the Christian view of reality is the true view of reality, what does that mean for the task of self-making? Can y'all hear me in the back? Okay. A little louder. You could sit a little closer, too. We're talking about shame. There's plenty of shame to spread around. All right. If I trail off, just wave at me, and I won't shame you again. Okay. Normally, I play Let It Go, the song from Frozen, but I didn't want to hassle with the AV. YouTube exists. You'll be fine. However, I am going to read some of the lyrics from Elsa's magnum opus. So the 2013 film Let It Go, the film is called Frozen, but I see I'm going to have problems in the back. The hit song, Let It Go, it's terribly catchy, so you're welcome that I'm not going to play it, because you'll be singing it for the rest of the day. The plot, I'll be referencing Frozen for the next hour, so I'm going to briefly sketch the plot. Elsa is to be crowned queen of Arendelle, and she has powers to control ice and snow. When she was a child, there was a terrible accident, and her sister Anna was hurt, and her family decided, because this has happened, we need to lock down on this gift of hers. Otherwise, it's going to get out of control. So she's isolated from the rest of the kingdom. She's taught to deny and repress this power that she has. And then, as the plot goes on, she comes of age. She becomes the queen. Other things happen. And this gift that's been repressed explodes out. And she flees. She flees the kingdom up onto this mountain where she can finally be herself. She can be free. She's done with all this repression and suppression and being behind closed doors that has characterized her whole life up to that point. And she walks up on this mountain, snow-covered mountain, and sings Let It Go. And as she's singing it, she's firing off these ice bullets, and she builds this beautiful ice castle. So at the end of the song, she's standing in this beautiful castle. She's totally changed. She's used her powers to change the way she looks. And she's alone. And it's wonderful. It's a triumphant anthem. So I'm going to read some of the lyrics. And then I will read a quote from another cultural thinker. And we'll be comparing these two. The second one is John Calvin. So we'll be comparing Elsa. Elsa and John Calvin will be foils. Foils this afternoon. So here's a redacted version of Let It Go. The wind is howling like the swirling storm inside. Remember, she's marching up onto the mountain. She's just turned her back in liberation and celebration on the repression that she's grown up with. Couldn't keep it in. Heaven knows I've tried. Don't let them in. Don't let them see. Be the good girl you always have to be. Conceal. Don't feel. Don't let them know. Well, now they know. Let it go, let it go. Can't hold it back anymore. Let it go, let it go. Turn away and slam the door. It's so hard not to sing this, but I'm not going to. You sing it. I don't care what they're going to say. And a few lines later, it's funny how some distance makes everything seem small. And the fears that once controlled me can't get to me at all. It's time to see what I can do, to test the limits and break through. No right, no wrong, no rules for me. I'm free. So there's her liberation anthem. No right, no wrong, no rules for me. I'm free. So here's 1536. We're winding back the clock a little bit. John Calvin. John Calvin disagrees with Elsa. Here we go. This is from the Institutes of the Christian Religion. You'll hear some dissonance between this and Let It Go. As consulting our own self-interest is the pestilence that most effectively leads to our destruction, so the sole haven of salvation is to be wise in nothing and to will nothing through ourselves, but to follow the leading of the Lord alone. Scripture calls us to resign ourselves and our possessions to the Lord's will and to yield to him the desires of our hearts to be tamed and subjugated. That's a far cry from no right, no wrong, no rules for me. Let the godly neither desire nor hope for nor contemplate any other way of prospering than by the Lord's blessing. Upon this, then, let them safely and confidently throw themselves and rest. For however beautifully the flesh may seem to suffice unto itself, it will not prosper apart from the Lord's blessing. It is for us to look to the Lord's guidance, that we may be led by the hand to whatever lot he has provided for us, and to totally resign ourselves to the Lord, to permit every part of our lives to be governed by his will. Wow, that's a far cry from Let It Go. So this, I wanted to start the lecture this way. We'll be talking a lot about isms and theoretical stuff, but I wanted this to help us feel the problem, feel the tension of identity. Something has changed. This, in 1536, Calvin could say that the basic task of the human soul is to totally resign ourselves to the Lord, to permit every part of our lives to be governed by his will. And then you have this anthem of self-liberation and autonomous freedom in Let It Go. So something has changed. There's been a cultural sea change in the past 500 years. The change affects what it means to be a self, how to make your way in the world, what you need for that, who you need for that, how long it takes. One view of the world and of the self has been dismantled and another built up in its place. So that's the first half of this lecture is going to tell that story a little bit. Okay, so we have the five pillars of the modern self. Point number one, disenchantment. So one of the big changes in the past 500 years is that we now understand reality to be disenchanted. When it comes to the task of self-making, the theme is, I am my own master. No right, no wrong, no rules for me, I'm free. In his book, A Secular Age, which is the primary source for this lecture, philosopher Charles Taylor maps a number of transitions over the past 500 years, and I'm going to boil those down to two. And one is, he calls the immanent frame, which is the disenchantment of the universe, and the buffered self, which is the disenchantment of the self. So we'll look at these two and then move on. So the first transition, the transcendent frame to the immanent frame. By transcendent, I mean open to the beyond, whereas the immanent is, there is no beyond. We have only the material. The pre-modern world was an ordered one from top to bottom, all in an enchanted framework. And by that I mean reality consisted of both the visible and the invisible, and you could go back and forth between the two. Things, one influenced the other and vice versa. The two realms were permeable to one another. So what is the sun in an enchanted framework? It is a god. What is a temple? It's a point where the gods or the realm of the gods intersects the realms of humanity. It's not just a site of therapeutic subjective value, like we often think of churches or religious sites. You know, nothing supernatural is going on there, but I get a lot of good things out of it. Over the past 500 years, the notion of the transcendent has tipped over into the notion of the immanent, and Taylor describes that every step of that transition. And if you're smarter than I am, you will be able to follow him. A Secular Age is a wonderful book, but it is pretty heavy. metaphorically and literally. So the immanent frame says that only the material is real. What science cannot account for doesn't exist. Everything, to use Taylor's phrase, is just atoms and their swervings, which it's 2022. We're all very familiar with materialism. Like that's kind of the uber narrative in Western society. So this idea has an effect on what it means to be a self in modern times. Because there's no beyond, there is no final authority that can place demands on your life. Ultimate demands, the kind of God-level demands. And so that's one consequence. Another consequence is the transition to the immanent frame marks an inversion in the hierarchy of the place of humanity in the cosmos. We once used to occupy a kind of middling spot in the hierarchy of beings, you know, above animals, below the gods. We now live in the God's palace. We're at the top of the pile. We are the sentience the universe has produced. And it's up to us to decide what to do with that. So that's the transition from the transcendent frame to the immanent frame. The second transition of disenchantment is from the porous self to the buffered self. Taylor makes up a lot of his own terminology, but it has a way of sticking. And for most of human history, it was thought that just as the earth could be affected and permeated by the invisible realm, so too people were porous or permeable to the spiritual world. So the king's sin could be the reason the kingdom's crops fail. You know, moral choices can affect the natural world. Your neighbor's infidelity could bring disease to a community, things like that. The bone of a saint can heal diseases. Think of medieval pilgrimages. People really were looking for tangible, real-world effects at the end of the pilgrimage when they could kiss that relic of a saint. It wasn't just something that would make them feel better. It was something that would release almost magical power into their lives. Today we call that superstition. You know, it's nice if you believe that, as long as you keep it to yourself. But we don't really engage with the supernatural realm in that sense. And that's even true of Christians. Christians have to kind of straddle this double realm. We're all materialists in some ways, or with one foot or one hand, and we're also supernaturalists. We can pray. But, we also hedge our bets and buy life insurance and, you know, do all these things that modernity has given us to insulate ourselves from true dependence on the supernatural. High security computing has given us an analogy of the buffered self in the air gap. If you're making the computer systems for, say, a nuclear power plant, the computers that run that will not be connected to the internet by, you know, any wires. There'll be no wireless or wired capability. They will be a universe into themselves. Nothing gets off those computers onto the internet. No malicious code gets from the internet onto the computers because there is an actual air gap between, you know, the wall and the computer. And that's how you know. The buffered self is this idea that we are those computers. There's a gap between us and everything else, between me and you, between my health and your morality. But that is a new invention. That's one of the inventions of modernity. People didn't used to see it like that, and it's so deeply ingrained in our views of reality. We have to kind of learn how other people used to think about it, think about this idea of a porous self. Possession is a good example. So how plausible is possession to you? That can be a kind of litmus test on how you really conceive of yourself as buffered or porous. It's kind of one of these old world concepts that are treated as superstition now. But then you open the Gospels and you read it's, you know, it happens in the Gospels, and you think, huh, how do I integrate this with my 21st century materialism? So let's draw some lines of connection between this idea of the buffer itself and what it means to make your identity as a modern person. You are fundamentally alone within yourself. Just as because of the imminent frame, we're alone in the universe, you are alone within yourself. And there is an unprecedented and unshakable freedom in this notion. You can give yourself to other things by consent, but you aren't fundamentally linked to them. To be a person today is to wield unimaginable freedom to anyone, 500 years ago. So like diners at a buffet, we can scoop things onto our soul's plate that we like, but they're not us. We can kind of accessorize with them. The world is full of things to a modern person that we can use as accessories to the self. But that is what they are. They're accessories. They're not you. So these two just disenchantments of the universe and of the self are the basic building blocks of the modern identity. That's one of the things that, paradigm level, they are operating whether or not you know them just by the fact that it's 2022. So that's the first point, disenchantment. The second point is autonomous freedom. This is the idea that I decide for myself what I am. Freedom defined this way holds that it's dangerous to the self to be constrained by any higher power. So the only way to protect that freedom is to at times separate yourself from external influence. And this idea flows from the disenchantment of the universe, that we're alone at the top of the pile. We are truly free. Think about Elsa. She sang, "It's time to see what I can do, to test the limits and break through. No right, no wrong, no rules for me. I'm free." When I was writing this lecture, I was listening to Spotify and this ad came on that said, it was trying to get me to upgrade to premium so I wouldn't have to listen to ads like that one. And the punchline of the ad was, "Life is better when nothing is stopping you." And I thought, I am writing that down. That just landed in my lecture. Autonomous freedom. Life is better when nothing is stopping you. How can you make your life better? Remove any impediment to your freedom. This has a couple consequences when it comes to the self. Let me read this short paragraph from Charles Taylor. He writes, "I'm free when I decide for myself what concerns me, rather than being shaped by external influences. There's a crucial moral importance to a kind of contact with myself, with my own inner nature, which is in danger of being lost, partly through the pressures towards outward conformity. I can't even find the model to live by outside myself. I can only find it within. Being true to myself means being true to my own originality, and that is something only I can articulate and discover." So you can see in this quote, he's capturing the way this ethic of autonomous freedom gives a pride of place to the interior life. Like I need to decide for myself the mode of life that's consistent with that freedom, with my values. And there's a suspicion of constraints that come from the outside. We got to keep a wary eye on those external constraints and pressures toward conformity, because they might do violence to my freedom, and that would do violence to myself. When you're free this way, you have to do a lot of the work of the self alone, because that's the only place it can be safely done. Looking inward can protect yourself from being co-opted by any agenda from the outside. And freedom in this sense is a moral good. It's a commodity to be gathered and used for the preservation of the self. Going back to Elsa, she was held as a prisoner in the palace for her childhood, and she acquired this terrible fear of what she could do. And so Let It Go is this song of liberation. She had lost herself. Her true self was taken away. And when she took back her freedom, she could take back her true self. She launched this quest out on the mountainside to become everything that she could be. But the lever that got her there was freedom. So for each of these, I'm just gonna fire a few shots across the bow and make quick critiques of that idea taken to its conclusion, and then move on. So the first one is the critique of flourishing. So when I think about autonomous freedom, I often think about where do questions of human flourishing come in and impinge upon the questions of freedom? So those two questions or needs can be at odds. I need to be absolutely free and I need to flourish. There are times when, in order to flourish, you need to constrain your freedom. If you've ever tried to lose weight, you will be familiar with the difficulty and necessity of not eating whatever you want, changing your behavior patterns so that you exercise more. Life is full of good reasons to deny your freedom in order to flourish, right? And often, the trick is, often the denial of freedom is the price to experiencing greater freedom. C.S. Lewis talks about if you want to learn Greek, you have to disciple yourself to the language of Greek. Or if you want to learn to play the piano, you have to give up a lot of your freedom, hours and hours and hours of your freedom. But only after you deny yourself what else you could be doing with those hours do you gain the freedom of the piano. And then you can make beautiful things with that freedom, which is what people want to do when they try to protect their freedom. They want to flourish. So there's a sophistication that you need to think about that with. The second one, subordination. When freedom becomes the ultimate rule of thumb for the construction of the self, I just wonder how you know when you're really free. Feeling free is not enough to really know if you're actually free. Often, you've traded one kind of stifling exterior constraint for another stifling exterior constraint that feels more free because it's new, or it's maybe gets you something that you wanted. Take the example of the university freshman who loses his faith because he gets to university and he's caught up in the hierarchical milieu of a fraternity life. And that he begins to feel some shifts in his value system, and then his college professor explains to him the scientific consensus that the supernatural isn't real, and he starts to look askance at the faith of his upbringing. And then he tosses off the mores and expectations of his parents and feels himself to be entering into this broader, more expansive, less restricted way of life. But I would say when you step back in this scenario, the options aren't restrictive religion or neutral freedom in which I can do whatever I want. You've rather just traded one worldview for another worldview, which feels new and free. But maybe it's not. Authenticity. This is number three. Disenchantment, autonomous freedom, authenticity. This is the idea that I'm true when I'm true to myself. The ultimate purposes for you are those which come from within. And if someone else has a purpose that is at cross purposes with that, to be authentic, you have to hold to your own. You have interior depths, and you need to be the only way to be okay as a person as you struggle to form your identity is to stay in touch with those. You have to stay in self-contact. So here's two more quotes from Charles Taylor. He writes, "We now conceive of ourselves as having inner depths. We might even say the depths within the depths which were previously located in the cosmos, in the enchanted world, are now located within." So I just live in a place where it's just atoms and their swervings. But ooh, inside myself, that's where the magic is. And there I've got an enchanted universe in there. And I'm going to go explore it. Here's another quote. "Our moral salvation comes from recovering authentic moral contact with ourselves." So he's talking about if you want to build your identity today, you've got to keep your finger on your pulse. And you have to always use your own intuitions and emotions as a kind of sonar ping for reality and read what comes back. You've got to see, gauge your own reaction. And that's how you remain authentic. So remember Elsa, as the song says, she was taught, don't let them in, don't let them see. Be the good girl you always have to be, which in this ethic of authenticity is an inauthentic way to be. That here's an external constraint, be the good girl I have to be, and I'm going to hide who I really am inside of that. So in the story, in the beginning of the story at least, she tried to be what they wanted her to be, and it brought ruin to the kingdom. You know, people got hurt. The kingdom was put in eternal winter. And it brought pain and tragedy into her life. So she has to separate and look inside herself out there on the ice mountain in order to find who she was really meant to be, and in order to create who she was really meant to be. So just one thought by way of critique on this. And it's similar to the question of how free are you really? I think the sense that this word authenticity is often bandied about with is that your authentic self is something that's easy to find. Because you just look within, you see it, and it's there. And it feels better, it makes sense, it's liberating. But I don't think it's necessarily that easy. For instance, think about the ad industry. The ad industry is an industry because people's authentic self, their sense of their self can be hacked. And you can be sold things. You can be convinced that you need things to become something else. So just buy this thing, you know? Old Spice makes you manly. The cool kids wear tight jeans. Like, just the jean length and level of constriction is totally arbitrary. There's no platonic ideal of jeans, but it just blows with the winds of shifting time. And the ad industry and the fashion industry makes you feel, ooh, I will be different if I have the tight jeans or the loose jeans or whatever. Here's an analogy from Tim Keller. You might be, in pursuing your authenticity, just following the dictates of the prevailing cultural mood. So here's what Tim Keller says. If you are a young 10th century Viking man who's sexually attracted to other men, your culture would tell you to suppress your sexual inclinations and develop your impulses toward physical violence. However, if you're a young gay New Yorker in the 21st century, your culture tells you to repress your urges for physical violence and develop your sexual inclinations. So, which of those two people is being more authentic? And how do you know? You know, you might just be succumbing, conforming to the prevailing cultural mood. And it is really hard to resist the cultural mood. You know, all of us are products of our moment in ways that none of us, no one can fully understand. There's so much pressure that we just deal with even below the level of our conscious awareness. Here's the fourth point. Performance of the self. So the modern creation of the self is a performance of the self. The fancy term for this is expressive individualism. This idea that I am what I become, and I can become whatever I want. It's the idea that in expressing myself, I am defining myself. The self is not heritable. It's not something that can be imbued or osmosed or, I don't know. It's not something that comes from the outside. I have to invent it. It has to be continually given shape in an ongoing work of performance. It was, I was listening to a guy named David Richter. And he was telling a story about a mom and a daughter, and they're shopping for a dress. And the mom says, the daughter says, you should get that dress. And the mom says, oh, that dress isn't me. And the daughter says, it could be if you wanted it to be. So there's this sense that actually, if you got that dress, which isn't you now, it can make you into someone else who does fit in the dress, if you buy the dress. So your identity is plastic, and it's this ongoing work of performance. Taylor said, being true to myself means being true to my own originality, and that is something only I can articulate and discover. And in articulating it, I'm defining myself. We discover what we have in us to become by becoming that mode of life. You get the dress, and then you become a person who fits the dress. So that's, his term is instrumental identity. So it refers to the confidence that modern people have that the self can be altered or augmented or hastened in its becoming. through the use of things exterior to the self, through the dresses and the jeans and the Old Spice. You can become that if you want to be, and this thing can help you. One story you could tell of the past 500 years is in which the grand meta-narratives that used to govern thought and time and history and human life have collapsed, or seem to have collapsed. They're left, an identity gap was left. And so humans who have to find something to fill that identity gap, to give them a grounds to stand on, to say, this is who I am, and this is why I am this way, acquired expressive individualism to fill the gap. So how do I become something, which we all have to be, and how do I know who I am? I gather things around me that will tell me, proclaim to myself who I am, to alter the self as needed, and will proclaim to the group who I am. So it's a kind of self-branding in which you you understand yourself to be a part of a group and distinct from a group, which is one of the basic human tasks. Let's think about Elsa. Let It Go captures the cultural moment because it's an anthem of self-performance. That's what she's doing up there. She has these nearly godlike powers when it comes to ice, and they're unleashed, and she builds this beautiful ice cathedral, which she is the only occupant of. So it's this, I'd say it's this picture of expressive individualism. She unleashes these powers and creates something which will now define her. So here's one critique of pursuing one's identity this way. I think it is a bit of a shell game, or can be a bit of a shell game. You know that game where there's three shells and the ball goes under one and they start moving around. You have to keep your eye on the ball. You try to figure out which shell is the ball actually under, and then the person doing the magic trick, you know, makes the ball disappear somehow. So if the self is created and defined by exterior things with which it is accessorized, if I am my flannel shirt and my glasses and my haircut and these things that you see, that I'm helping you see, if that is the self, what sense is there in calling that self me? Like if the shells are moving, you know, and we make our shells move for one another, how do you really know that there's a ball underneath one of them still? Like at what point does you, as a collection of things with which you used to define you, become just a kind of hollow suit of armor? And where is the you inside the performance? Does that make sense? So in the shell game, there's a lot of movement, but where's the ball? Is the ball still there? Are we sure the ball is still there? Here's the last part of this first part of the talk, constructed meaning. So that's the fifth pillar of the modern self, constructed meaning. Meaning in the modern universe doesn't descend from on high because there's nothing up there. However, we significant beings down here are such things as can create meanings and manifest them into the world. So all meanings in the modern world are grassroots. It's all from the ground up. And we can make these beautiful, beautiful cathedrals just like Elsa did. But there's nothing up there. Here's, again, going back to Charles Taylor. He says, in a universe that is absent of purpose, nothing is demanded of us. We have no destiny with which we are called on to achieve, on pain of damnation or divine retribution. We are alone in the universe. All meaning is here in this small speck. So there are no meta-meanings. It's all just happening inside of us as individuals, and inside of the communities and societies we make. And it's actually our job to infuse the universe with meaning, to impose our meanings on an otherwise meaningless universe. Otherwise, it just, all the meaninglessness collapses back in on itself. So what does that have to do with the self? It shouldn't come as a surprise that we each have to define ourselves and assign our values that are meaningful, because there is no other meaning available. We have to assign our own meanings. We're just like Elsa, you know, up there on the frozen mountaintop, faced with a colossal task of building an ice palace that we can then live in. So, and just as meanings can be made, they can also be unmade. They can become very flexible when there's no ultimate, absolute authority behind them. Now, if you find yourself like Elsa, trapped in a meaning prison of someone else's making, that's where she spent her childhood, the only responsible thing for you to do is to free yourself, to throw off all those oppressive, repressive meanings that others have given you and go define your own. Create a more beautiful self. So here's a quick critique of that. For all the promise of human-made meaning and for all the flexibility and adventure of that task, you're still left with a serious problem, I think, that of soft significance. Private individual meanings that can only be authoritative by mutual consent. So my meanings have no inherent sway over you unless you agree that they do. Then, so you run into this problem that the meanings of one person or one nation are not able to permeate or control or hold sway over the meanings of anyone else. And that while that might be desirable in that it's consistent with modern cultural values of, say, tolerance, that you do your thing, I'll do my thing, we'll do our thing, you guys do your thing, and we'll lead to this will lead to a happy and peaceful world. We still keep making these groundless absolute value statements as if that weren't true. That's just, tolerance is just a fiction that we're going to pretend, but I still find myself compelled to say things like the Rwandan genocide was wrong, or people shouldn't own guns. Or people should own guns. Don't take my guns away from me. Or women shouldn't be forced to have sex with men. Like we, no matter how much we talk about the significance and the utility of soft meanings, of self-made meanings, we still try to make these absolute meaning statements. So if one's meaning structures can be built and unbuilt like Legos, why do my fabricated meanings take priority over any of yours? Why should they? The answer is they don't. And so meaning gets, significance itself gets softer, which I would say is a problem. There's an inconsistency there. We're done with the modern self. Now we're going to move on to part two of the lecture. Somehow it's 4:10. Fine. We have until 4:30. Yeah, 4:45. Yep, okay. Right, we're fine. So the five pillars of the self in God's reality. Here they are. I'm going to go through all five quickly. The creature and the creator, the necessity of relationship, the image of God, the reality of the fall, and the work of the Spirit. And now we're done. Thanks for coming, everybody. Okay, so that's just kind of a preview of where we're going. The first one, the creature and the creator, just as the modern self is built on the cornerstone of the disenchantment of the universe. The cornerstone of the Christian self is the enchantment of the universe. And actually in that, the fact that we are the creations of a creator. And as such, human flourishing is found in inhabiting the givens of reality and of the self. We didn't make ourselves. And we're not our own. We don't belong to ourselves. We are the creation of God. So I'm not going to prove that. I'm just going to assert it. And you can figure out how this can be true and this can be true, or how to make them agree and disagree. You're going to have to work on that on your own. I'm just going to say this is the Christian view of the self, built on the reality of God as creator. The universe is created in a certain way with certain bounds, and we are creatures made to fit in our proper place in God's universe. So if you're not asleep yet and you've been paying attention, you should feel some tension there. It's a bit uncomfortable with the self I just described, the Elsa self. We're in the John Calvin self now. This means that reality has givens. Reality has things you can bend and you can change and recreate. And that's part of the agency of what it means to be a human person. But that reality has also lots of things you can't change, and you will never change. And if you try to bend them, they might break you. And that means going against those givens can cause pain and loss and chaos. And ultimately, we're not infinitely pliable. We're not plastic. We can grow and change, and that's one of the wonders of being a self in God's reality, but we can't grow and change into anything safely. And though the idea is repulsive to modern sensibilities, being your true self begins with bowing to God as God in both the external world and the internal world, which is a strange, repulsive, I think wonderful, oxymoronic paradox. That if I want to be my true self, I have to give myself to God and then receive it back from him. Another Calvin quote. Calvin writes, as old school as only someone in 1536 can be, he writes, "We are not our own. Let not our reason nor our will therefore sway our plans and deeds. We are not our own. Let us therefore not set it as our goal to seek what is expedient for us according to the flesh. We are not our own. Insofar as we can, let us therefore forget ourselves and all that is ours. Conversely, we are God's. Let us therefore live for him and die for him. We are God's. Let his wisdom and will therefore rule all our actions. We are God's. Let all parts of our lives strive toward him as our only goal." Calvin gets a bad rap, but when you actually read him, there's some really great stuff in there. So for each of these five pillars of the Christian self, I'm going to look back at a couple of the pillars of the modern self and compare and contrast. So what does this reality, that we are creatures and there is a creator, say about disenchantment? In contrast to being a buffered self in the immanent frame, the invisible realm is real, and it permeates the visible world at every point. Francis Schaeffer used to hold up his hand and say, "The supernatural is here." Isn't that a wonderful and harrowing thought? That we often make the mistake of thinking of the supernatural as there, but the supernatural is here, right here. There isn't another place it is. It's among us. Reality is enchanted, even magical, ultimately because there is a personality behind it that sustains it and interacts with the world and has the power to impose its meanings on the world. So what does this say for the idea, that pillar of the modern self, that we have to make our meaning, so self-constructed meaning? If we are creatures and there is a creator, reality is the creation of an infinitely wise and good mind, whose meanings exceed those we can imagine, let alone equal. And God has imbued his creation with these meanings, even down to the smallest aspect. So rather than us being left with only atoms and their swervings, and we have to build up our ice palaces all by ourselves, we are newcomers to a whole world of meanings that pre-existed us and that we get to discover. And those meanings are the products of an infinitely creative, wise, and good God, and the products of everyone else. And that's kind of the beauty and the heady responsibility of being a human, is that not only do you get to discover the pre-made meanings, but you get to create them. So that God, there's a picture of that in Genesis 1, that God makes the animals. Adam didn't make the animals, but God does not name them. And he brings them to Adam and waits to find out what Adam will name them. And then that is what they are named. It's a lovely way to introduce humanity to the world. That we do get to make things. So human meanings ought to take their place alongside and on top of and supporting God's meanings. And that's true in the world at large, and it's true inside your own self. And that the task we face is to discover and amplify God's good meanings in your life and through your life into the world. That we're supposed to vector God's meanings, vector and amplify God's meanings in our lives. So that's the first bit. The second one, the necessity of relationship. This is another strong contrast to the modern self. The modern self is an isolated self. Remember, you're the air gap computer. You are buffered. Even if you're packed together with other people, like molecules of gas in a cloud, you are not linked to them. You're isolated. You are alone in the universe, alone in a crowd, even alone inside your own self. But this isn't the case with Christianity. Christianity holds to the poorest self. It's not built on the cornerstone of the isolation of the individual, but it's built on the cornerstone of God, who is three and one. So there is a linkedness and a relationality to reality at its most essential level, which is God. It's not the atomic level or the quantum level. The most essential level is God. And at that most essential level, there's a multiplicity, a relationship, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. So relationship pervades all of creation. And if the New Testament is true, that the three-person God will come and make his home inside your very own self, inside your little buffered self, which is not very buffered, right? If the fundamental building block of reality, God himself, can live inside you, that's not very buffered. The Trinity is also present in the community of believers, which the Bible calls his body. So that is the fundamental nature of relationship. It's one of the fundamental pillars of your selfness is your interlinkedness. Somebody said community. That is totally true. But the modern self trades on a totally different coin. I am me first and not us first. What does this mean for authenticity? Being true to yourself can become a recursive narcissistic spiral. Unfortunately, it can. If you follow your own bliss above all others, you can destroy your own life and the life of everyone you meet. You're a dog chasing your own tail. Not always. There is a good and praiseworthy goal of authenticity. I'm not saying authenticity is bad. But authenticity as a god is bad news. When it becomes an end in and of its own self and a justification for any course of action, you just keep choosing the self over relationship. One of the things that can guard against that is anchoring yourself to an external point or an external commitment, patriotism, a marriage, a community. All of these things can kind of anchor you and hold you back from the narcissistic spiral that not everyone who wants to be authentic dives into, but it is a danger when taken too far. But all of those, I would argue, are still within creation and thus not distant enough. They are good. The human person is supposed to be anchored into a place and a time and a people, but ultimately, that anchoring is a function of a further anchoring in God, who is outside and inside of creation, transcendent and immanent. Because culture can always change, marriage can always change. The whims of one's time, one's national agenda can always change. But God is the same yesterday, today, and forever. So if you are aligning the realities of yourself with the realities of God, you will be further made more safe from the narcissistic spiral. Second thing, freedom. What does the reality of the necessity of relationship have to say about this ideal of autonomous freedom? In The Second Mountain, a book by David Brooks, he offers a definition of the formation of the self that cuts right across the grain of the ethic of autonomous freedom. Brooks writes, "Character is a byproduct of giving yourself away. You love things that are worthy of love. You surrender to a community or a cause. You make promises to other people. You build a thick jungle of loving attachments. You lose yourself daily in the act of serving others as they lose themselves in the daily act of serving you." So Brooks is saying that character is a byproduct of giving yourself away. not necessarily freedom wielded as the ultimate tool of self-definition becomes a sword that just cuts things away. Whereas Brooks is offering a different view to finding yourself, and that is to give yourself away, which is a thoroughly Christian view. You love people and a community and a place and a time. Give yourself to things, and then you get those things back. You send yourself into them, yourself is enlarged in their company, and then it's returned to you. But perpetual disembedding cuts you off from that thing, from that enlargement, and then giving it, getting yourself as a gift back from the people and things you've given it to. But if you're always disembedding, you don't get that. Now, the catch is, you have to give yourself. So yourself has to be impinged upon. I think it was Einstein that said, love is imposition. So if you make yourself, if you build a life for yourself that flees from imposition at any cost, you will miss out on that. Third thing, the image of God. A human being is a glorious knot of given meanings with a sacred calling to rule creation with God. So there's my definition of what a human being is. A glorious knot tied together, interlinkedness of given meanings, something that meanings that are given to humanity by God with a sacred calling to rule creation with him. The first chapters of Genesis give a powerful picture of this. And humanity is defined as being as a being who bears the image of God. And that means to be human is to already have an identity and a purpose. So if you are a being made in the image of God, you have an identity and a purpose. Let's look at the identity. Your identity is found in the ways you resemble God, your maker. The Christian self is one that in which the image of God is being progressively restored and amplified, getting bigger and more beautiful as over the course of your life. And this means you aren't just a blank slate with a task to self-create, but your task is to grow into God's preordained meanings for you, and as you more clearly and fully bear his image. So you already have an identity. You also already have a purpose. The image of God gives us a telos, an end to which we're striving. In ancient times, when a king conquered a territory, he would often leave a statue of himself behind. And that statue was not just a monument, it was the king. It represented the king's rule, so that if you overthrew the king's rule, you would have to destroy the statue first. So the idea of a being made in the image of God is trading on this ancient contemporary concept that you are the image of God. You are the image of the king. And so wherever the statue is, wherever the image is, around that point is a circle of the king's rule, the kingdom of God. So that is your purpose. Your identity is to bear the image of God and come to resemble your maker more and more. And your purpose as a being who bears that image is to extend his rule in everything that means everywhere you go. So that the places Christians build should be like these little kingdoms with rippling effects of God's ways expanding outward from them. What does this mean? What does this have to do with the modern self? So we'll look at freedom and self-performance. Freedom. If this account of humanity is true, then we're not nearly as free as we might think. Given meanings, by merit of being given, imply limitations. So you have moral limitations. You have rational limitations. Social limitations. Spiritual, physical, emotional. You are a thing God made. And when you go, you pull yourself or press yourself beyond those limitations, you can distort yourself. It isn't necessarily true that if you pursue any bearing to its nth degree, pursuing your freedom, that you'll get better and better. You might actually go beyond these given meanings, these boundaries, social, moral, relational, emotional boundaries in which you're supposed to dwell instead of transcend. You can do violence to yourself. Second thing, self-performance. The modern self is inward focused. The Christian self is drawn upward and outward. So our task is not to define ourselves by expressing ourselves, you know, gathering things which we can then use to project ourselves onto the world. Rather, it is to act on the world in a cosmic stage, to fulfill the original role of Adam and Eve as God's imagers, to rule creation together with God. So it's not just projecting a certain image, but actually ruling creation as God's viceroys, which I would say is a higher calling. And all that is true not despite what you find inside yourself, which you have to find a way to hide from others or change or alter, but because of it. It's 4:30. I've only gotten through three of the five pillars of the Christian self. How will you become selves if you don't know the last two pillars? Now I'm going to do these two very quickly, just in 5 minutes, and then we'll have some time. So the reality of the fall. Everything is broken. And that includes us, ourselves. So there's a lot more than just diamonds inside you. And if you do have inner depths, and if you go diving down in there, what you find might not be very nice. You know, it's not valid just because it was really there inside you. It might be quite an ugly thing. It might be something, like Dick was saying, of which you should be ashamed instead of glorying. So just because it's there and it is authentically part of who you are right now doesn't mean it should be praised. There's more to say. We can come back to that, but I want to have time for questions. So that's the fourth one, the reality of the fall. Lastly, the work of the Spirit. In God's reality, identity is bestowed, not only self-created. Each person is God's workmanship. So in the days and hours and years of our lives, God is shaping and teaching and transforming us using every circumstance and relationship in our lives. Every success, every failure, every triumph, every defeat. Ephesians 2:10 says, "We are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them." So we don't only construct ourselves, but God builds us into the people he wants us to be. And he had something in mind when he made you, and throughout the years of your life, years of your existence, which, by the way, is forever, God will slowly and progressively make you into that person as you can bear it, which takes a lot of time. I'm always struck by Jesus in John 16 saying to the apostles, "I have so much more to tell you, but you can't bear it now. But I will send the Spirit of truth, and he will lead you into all truth," which I understand to be an unending process into eternity.